Good morning. Thank you. We'd like to welcome everyone to the study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, May 26, 2011. I'd like to excuse Councilmember Glover and the Vice Mayor, who will not be here with us this morning. The first item on the agenda is to hear a presentation to discuss the Sustainable Communities Working Group. Mr. James. Ms. Shannon, Ms. Teresa. We're pretty informal here. We go by
good. We like that.
Sort of a southern approach to things.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. It's a great privilege to be here this morning, talk about a unique and exciting partnership that we've begun some time ago. I've got with me for the TV audience Shannon Scutari. She's the director of Rail and Sustainability for the Arizona Department of Transportation. And we also have Teresa Bryce, who is the Arizona Director of LISC. So with that, I'll just let them start right in with the presentation.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much. I like how you said, you know, we have a TV audience, so wherever that is, it's really wonderful. We're getting some exposure here. We really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today, because one of the things that we think is really important about the future opportunities for transportation funding and all of the community development funding is that the real trend is about pulling together resources and partners of many, many different, from many diverse areas. And so what we have done is assembled a partnership from the state, the region, the local entities, as well as the nonprofits and the private sector, to come together to really focus on what kinds of funding opportunities are out there that maybe Arizona has been really not as competitive for, because we have, instead of been pulling together, we've sort of been competing against each other in Arizona. This is a message that I know that you all are really sending, and that your mayor has, in representing all of you out in the community and in the country, been really focusing on that Mesa is a leader in pulling together intergovernmental partners. You can go to the next one. So who are our partners? We have the state, the Departments of Housing and Transportation, the three cities that are focused around the light rail geography, Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, Metro Rail, the ASU Stardust Center for Affordable Homes and the Family, LISC, RASA Development Fund, ULI, Downtown Phoenix Partnership, Phoenix Community Alliance, Arizona Community Foundation, Discovery Triangle, and St. Luke's Health Initiative. And I do want to go back just a little bit when we talk about the opportunities of linking housing and transportation, because I see a lot of familiar faces as I'm here speaking with you today. And I really want to highlight that these partnerships that have led us to the point where we are today with our transportation opportunities started many, many years ago, and Mesa was really a leader in a lot of those when we were working on Proposition 400 together. There was a lot of opportunities when the cities were coming together, all the jurisdictions, to work on Prop 400. I was honored enough to be a part of that as the intergov for the city of Tempe. And I worked with Councilmember Kavanaugh and several of you to do some things in that time frame 10 years ago that people thought would never happen. Folks said, you'll never get a train. You'll never get Mesa and Tempe and Phoenix to come together to focus on getting something together and to partner. You'll never get Prop 400 off the ground because all the cities will never come together to agree on anything. You'll have the West Valley saying that they want all of this. You'll have the East Valley saying that they want all of this. And you'll have Phoenix drawing a line in the sand and saying they want all of this. The only way we were able to get the sales tax extended and to get a train running through three cities with a fourth that will actually be connected within the next 10, 15 years, was all of us working together. So that's why when we talk about the success of the light rail line, we really need to focus on how can the cities, again, pull together and take all of this to the next level of success. We find around the country that a big focus is about how it's really not accurate to just look at the cost of housing as far as the impact on an everyday citizen, a financial impact. You have to also combine the cost of housing and transportation so folks are mindful of how much they actually, the burden, the financial burden that they have to pay. So what we're finding from the Housing and Transportation Affordability Index is that the combination of housing and transportation can sometimes be 50 to 60% of the income, the monthly, yearly income of folks, instead of just the usual thought that, oh, 30% of what I make goes to my housing. Well, what we're finding now is typically when you add the transportation piece, it's 50 to 60% of what you're making is going to your housing because of the transportation. So this coalition is saying that focusing that intergovernmental partnership, not just with the local jurisdictions, but with the state and the nonprofits and the private sector, that we can all channel those energies into placemaking. Placemaking gives the opportunities to create different types of housing and outcomes, to make the light rail the success that it can be, create those economic opportunities, and have those sustainable communities that we all give so much lip service to. Why does place matter? Well, it matters because young educated people are being disproportionately drawn to certain cities. We are educating folks here, a whole generation of folks, the millennials, and they are getting a very high quality university education. And what we're finding is that we're finding they're very mobile. And they aren't finding the kinds of housing opportunities that they want here in Arizona. The demographic shift is changing the market dramatically. So 61% in the year 2000 of those high-end, talented millennial workers, which are so sought after by all the corporations that are thinking of locating in different particular geographic areas, those are the folks that when we say we need jobs, we need the talent to be here to be able to attract the corporations that have the high-paying jobs. Well, those talented workers in the year 2000, 61% of them said that they were more likely to live in closed-in urban neighborhoods. Again, something we don't necessarily offer here in Arizona. In 2011, they are 94% more likely. So when we talk about all these things and we focus on the reason that the partnership is so important, another thing that's happening at the federal level is this focus on livability. Well, livability, like sustainability, like placemaking, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But one thing we do keep seeing around the country is those groups of folks that are coming together to apply for federal grant opportunities or who are receiving hundreds of millions of dollars to actually catalyze the kind of community development that we're talking about with you today. They are defining livability as a way for the housing, the transportation, and the environmental pieces to all come together so that folks can start working with each other in ways that they've never worked with each other before. So whenever you get some money, you always get a new amount of attention to these things. And so one of the things that not only are we working at the intergovernmental level with all of you in Phoenix and Tempe to come together with our common purpose, but we're also attracting the attention of investors. And this is what's actually helping us to take this working group to another level. There are folks out there in areas outside of the state that are taking a real interest in the work of the Sustainable Communities Working Group. So far, we've raised $20 million. This is for loans. And this is coming $10 million from LISC National and $10 million from RASA Development Fund. Our goal is to raise $50 million at least, equity, grants, potential subsidies. And that would be focused on catalyzing, incentivizing affordable residential development at the light rail stations, the essential related developments such as grocery stores for access to fresh and healthy food, childcare facilities to support working families, healthcare facilities to increase access to healthcare, and all the project costs associated with that ancillary development, sidewalks, bike paths, shade structures, and other community improvements. So we have a launch celebration. You're all invited. I know I've worked with your fabulous staff and council aides, and it's on your calendar. We hope to see you. It's next Wednesday. And it's an opportunity for us to work. We've invited the development community, the nonprofit community, and a whole host of folks to be at that celebration, and we invite you personally to come next week. One of the things that, when we go back in, how were the seeds planted for this kind of work? Prop 400 is one thing that we know was very influential in giving us the transportation infrastructure that we have now and that we will have for the next 10, 15, 20 years. But the focus is also, what are we doing now to capitalize on the changes that we're seeing in our economy, in our demographic shifts? It's the first time where the aging baby boomers and the young millennials really agree on something. They agree that they want freedom in the way that they live, and that transportation and community development linked to those amenities and that freedom is really the way they want to live. So another seed that was planted is the opportunity over a couple of different governors' administrations. This is all runs through not just one governor administration, but several governor administrations to get these things. As you know, they're long-term projects. Something that I want Teresa to focus on, which is some community and grassroots work that she worked on for creating the sustainability, making sustainability
sustainable communities
happen. Making sustainability communities happen.
LISC was, in 2007, convened a community forum to talk about the sustainable future of our communities. And one of the things we all agreed on is we have to grow differently. I think we've seen the effects of growth on our communities. You've heard about the impact of transportation costs. But the impact to cities is that there's a continuing financial burden as we spread farther and farther out from our established infrastructure. And that burden is carried by the cities. And so what we are trying to think about is how we can grow differently. And that's when we decided that we've really got to offer an alternative to our previous development patterns. And one of the things that everyone agreed on was that our entire community needs to be educated about how these development patterns can change and what the benefits are to them. So we pulled together a group of 25 stakeholders from all across the valley, different sectors, different regions, a great deal of diversity. And we came up with these principles that we felt really summarized what needs to be exemplified as our communities grow. And you can see here, we've talked about many of them, transportation choices, a mix of land uses, which means that people don't have to drive as far because residential is nearby to where the jobs are. A range of housing choices, certainly making sure that our workforce is placed close to jobs and can access those jobs easily because they can afford where they live and they're close to where they work. Thriving economies is certainly more important than ever. Compact development is another way of saying density, and I know density is a difficult word for us to hear, but we have created an entire calculator which shows how increased density can lead to reduced water use, reduced air pollution, a variety of different benefits that can help individuals, neighborhoods, and whole communities. Environmentally responsive design, you know, that's what most people think of when they think of green development, but it also means that being in a location that is environmentally responsive is equally important. Having safe places, certainly the emphasis on health keeps coming up over and over again, and then probably most importantly is engaging all of the community to understand why certain changes need to be made.
So when we worked on these items and the grassroots movement was working to educate communities on these shifts, there was an incredible amount of support. And so at the state level at that time, what we did is we assembled a smart growth scorecard. We have now taken that smart growth scorecard, which I am proud to say has been adopted by 87 of our, I guess we're at 91 cities and towns throughout the state and all of the counties, that scorecard, the Smart Growth Scorecard, we've actually been able to take that now and specifically focus it on those scorecard elements, those metrics that are essential in transit-oriented development, the kinds of development that helps to feed the success of high-capacity transit areas, such as the light rail geography, and helps to actually create the vibrant dynamic communities we're all talking about when we talk and conceptualize about livability. So what we're doing at the Sustainable Communities Working Group is we have a draft transit-oriented development scorecard, and we're connecting those metrics based on the Making Sustainable Communities Happen work to the funding. So we're not mandating that legally. We're not going down and trying to change any sort of statutory requirements or ordinances. What we're doing is we're connecting it to the funding so that to actually be eligible for this funding, then you would have to, the development community would have to follow those metrics in the scorecard. Another piece that's really key is the work of the Arizona Department of Housing. And what we see there is a lot of innovation. And we like to see innovation coming out of the state. So what is the Arizona Department of Housing has done is they have actually created a higher level of points for low-income tax credit housing if that housing is within a half a mile of a light rail station. That has been really a big change in the way that we've done things in focusing those resources towards transit-oriented development. So what I'd like to do, I know all of you, you speak on this, your staff, you're working very hard on, you've passed resolutions so that the FTA knows that you do have the commitment to transit-oriented development. That's helped you get federal funding by partnering with those other two cities to express your commitment to transit-oriented development and make the light rail as successful as it can be. So now I'd just like to thank you very much for having us here today. We are excited to work with your community as one of the partners, and we want to be this outside group that actually helps you to make these things as successful as they can be.
Okay, Councilman Richens. Thank you, by the way. Thank you. We'll open up for questions.
Thanks for that presentation. I think it's really exciting to see. The thing I've observed, that one of the biggest challenges to doing transit-oriented development has been financing. And banks don't completely understand it. There's been some fits and starts, people trying to do smart growth or new urbanist-type developments, and they're tough to do. We're prescribing how much retail should be part of it and not really letting the market shake that kind of stuff out. And so the banks are a little skittish around it. So to have a pot of money put together to help encourage it, particularly for us right now, we're going to be under construction, and this fund's going to be in place. So I think it presents an amazing opportunity for us to be able to have this money leveraged during light rail construction so we can open projects and light rail at the same time. The first segment didn't have this kind of finance stuff in place. Some great projects happened, though, for a variety of reasons. The other thing I like about the principles they're talking about is this is really about choice. There's not a lot of housing choice in this market other than single-family homes and your typical suburban apartment. That's, there's a few, but there's not a lot in the market. And, when we talk about changing development patterns and, that brings more cost-effectiveness for getting city services out there, but we don't have a lot of choices for, hip, young, urban-type folks to come into this market. You got a suburban-style house, you got a trailer, or a manufactured home, or an apartment, and so I think it'd be really interesting to see this kind of housing choice come into this market finally.
Well, there's one other segment that's just come up recently that we keep talking about these hip young,
but
move downs.
Yes,
Mesa,
correct.
Especially higher income, Mesa has no housing stock for move downs. And we talk about our brain drain of people, of young people moving out of the city because there's no way. We also, when we have people who have lived in, gated communities, estate lots in North and Northeast Mesa, when they sell this, 5,000 or 6,000 square. There's no place for them to go.
That's right.
And one of the demographics that is starting to pick up, and the interesting thing about our light rail in our ridership is that we have a lot more seniors. God, I mean, they're now, so I was going to find gray hair. Technically, I am.
That's
one thing that's been interesting when you look at our metro ridership. We have a much higher percentage of seniors riding our metro than other systems do. It's an interesting phenomenon, but because that's part of what spreads out our peak period. Mm-hmm. And makes our metro unique of any system in the country, where we don't have a drive time work peak in the morning and the afternoon. It's pretty consistent throughout the day, and a lot of that are our older citizens who don't want to drive in. And I think one of the things we're really missing is that opportunity for move downs for older people, who empty nesters, mm-hmm. who want to move in. We have zero in Mesa that I know of, but maybe a couple real small projects, especially in the northern part mm-hmm. of the city. Mm-hmm. That's another market that I think we're going to see moving into mm-hmm. these more urbanistic, especially transportation-related, because mm-hmm. that's a lifestyle that they're embracing.
Right.
It's a simple, easier lifestyle. It's a walkable lifestyle, and
right.
and they can get to the major points that they want to go to, whether it be Mesa, downtown Tempe, downtown Phoenix, the sports and arts venues, much easier than if they get in the car and drive. So I think it's one area. Also, one thing I just have to mention, we talked a lot here about affordable housing, and I really appreciate the emphasis and recognizing that these need to be a mixed type of thing, that they're not exclusive just type of communities, because that's not how these projects should be a microcosm of the community, which
Correct.
Means you have a diversity of people, because that's what makes for a great community. I want to, you can take that too far, though, in people understanding, and they start thinking that these are glorified housing projects.
That's right.
Which they are not. At least that's not how I envision it. I don't think that's what you envision.
Not at all.
You just point out that it's an opportunity to create a mixed, if I'm understanding you correctly, is that right?
Mayor and members of the council, that is absolutely the case. This is an opportunity to make sure that there is that diversity, that there is the funding for the opportunities for the middle income, the workforce housing, and a mix of housing choices. Those are the folks that work in our communities. We want them to have the opportunity to live in our communities around the light rail line. When those of us worked hard to put our energy into creating this momentum for the funding source, for the regional funding source for light rail to happen, we did it not because only one type of demographic could live next to light rail. We did it because we believed that this is an opportunity for everyone paying into the system. It's an extremely regressive tax, the sales tax, that was an opportunity for everybody to find housing choices and community development around the light rail. This helps to open up those opportunities and those new markets around the light rail line, not to just be exclusively, like you said, some sort of glorified affordable housing or project housing, but that this is an opportunity to not leave out that diversity that we want. And you can speak to that, too.
I do want to mention that both the two primary investors right now, LISC and Raza Development Fund, are mission-driven entities.
Yeah.
We are both community development financial institution, and as such, we are directed to provide our funds to meet a mix of incomes, but to focus primarily on people who have not had access to opportunity. And we see this, you know, when we look at what the market has already produced along the light rail, we look at very, very high-end luxury housing. You know, you think about 44 Monroe, you think about One Lexington. These are the kinds of housing developments that the market will bring without any assistance at all. I think, as Dave pointed out, access to this set of funds is something outside the usual market-driven demand. And so these funds will come with strings, and those strings are that we want to ensure that everyone in the community has access to opportunity that the light rail provides.
And we think this is a perfect opportunity with the economy in the situation that it is for us to capitalize on those opportunities. We believe that the type of housing right now or opportunities around light rail failed because they misjudged the market. We think the middle-income families that do want this kind of living with the younger generation, the millennials I was talking about, the talented workers, and the aging baby boomers, we think there's a mix of income opportunities there. And we just want to be able to offer those options and not let a whole segment of middle-income folks, which we think actually is the market right now, we don't want to leave them out.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to next week.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, the next item is to hear a presentation, discuss, provide direction on a concept for Creative Economy Fund, offering a process for nonprofit organizations to apply for reduced rent for use at the Mesa Arts Center. Ms. Ornstein.
Good morning, Mayor and City Council. I'm glad to be here. And just a reminder, so is this my, am I under control of the PowerPoint? So if I, do I just, oh, okay, that's them. Okay, you're going to do it for me. Thank you. Yes, otherwise I have to say next. Thank you very much, Kevin. Okay, great. Thank you very much. So first of all, it's so exciting to present right after the immediate prior presentation because I think that they're actually related. This is a small project, a small effort that's meant to be one of many building blocks. As you know, we have many initiatives in the community that are moving us towards creating a creative economy, a livable community, a place where, among others, young people want to live. So today I'm presenting to you something that is a part of a cumulative effort over time that I think joins forces with many of my colleagues in wanting to, and I think doing very effective things, to move our city and our downtown forward. This project, which I'm calling the Creative Economy Fund, is based on the idea that we're seeking to enhance that arts and culture environment in downtown Mesa, and specifically at our crown jewel, the Mesa Arts Center. And so, first of all, I want to tell you about our current situation, just remind you, I think you all remember that at present, beginning last year and continuing this year, the Department of Arts and Culture is providing $15,000 in in-kind support to the Mesa Arts Center founding resident companies. And for the viewers, to remind folks that the founding resident companies are, in fact, a group of organizations who in part, are the reason that the Mesa Arts Center is there, the Mesa-based organizations that have their seasons in our facilities. That $15,000 currently allocated is divided by the size of the rental use, percentage of total rental use of MAC facilities, and it's provided in the form of rent reduction or marketing assistance, although most of the organizations are taking it in the form of rent reduction. There have been discussions, and it came about through those discussions that there is an interest among some in city leadership to provide additional support to area arts organizations, and for arts programming, I should say, because I think we're looking more broadly at organizations that want to do cultural programming, whether they're arts organizations or other kinds of community organizations. There have been cuts to state and federal funding that makes the need greater than it's been before. The sustainability of cultural organizations is in some cases threatened, especially smaller organizations, but really they all have their struggles. This proposal will create an opportunity to attract new groups to both Mesa and the Mesa Arts Center. In addition to the obvious goal of being supportive to organizations that are important to the community and to the region, there are five primary goals in this proposal. One is to enable organizations who don't currently use our theaters, lecture hall, studios, or shadow walk to have the opportunity to do so through reduced rental fees. We would like to encourage the organizations that work with us to increase their community engagement or education activities and to increase their audience development activities. So we want to use this as an incentive for them to expand their horizons and do more to benefit the community. We also want to incentivize longer-term relationships. So we, you'll see, and when I talk about how the program works, that we want to encourage people not to just come in once, but to come in multiple times or for multiple days. In terms of community direct benefit, it hopefully will bring new programs and activities to the Mesa community that they don't currently enjoy. And it will have an economic benefit because we would, as we provide a subsidized rental fee, the remainder of the costs would be new earned revenue to our organization. The proposal is a creative economy fund, and it would provide in-kind support in the form of rent reduction to both current users and including the founding resident companies and others, and non-users. We envision a competitive process with an application that would be administered by the department at the Mesa Arts Center and Arts and Culture Department with input from the Museum and Cultural Advisory Board. We're looking at the proposal is for a fund of, and this is to start, hopefully it would have legs in the future and prove itself successful and have an opportunity to grow. We had a fund of $25,000, which would be in-kind rental credit for use of those spaces I mentioned. It would be split between the founding resident companies and the current non-users or other users. So we want to protect the fact that the founding resident companies have a strong long-term commitment and to us by showing that we, in turn, have a commitment to them and want to help them succeed and grow. So we're recommending splitting the amount for distribution, $10,000 for the founding resident companies and $15,000 for others. For the new rental users, they would have to be a nonprofit cultural organization or a nonprofit presenting programs that incorporate arts and culture. So they could be someone from a different kind of community organization that wants to do an arts and cultural project or presentation. In the in looking at the criteria, we would give extra points, if you will, or weight their proposals if they were looking at multi-use or multi-day projects and presentations to enhance the relationship building that I spoke about. And we would give extra points for incorporating education or community engagement activities as part of their project to benefit the community even more than just their presentation or event. For the current rental users, and this applies to both the founding resident companies and others who are ongoing users, examples would be Salt River Brass, the Martin Luther King Committee that has a festival after their parade. So it's a broad base of current rental users. We would be looking at them to be required to expand an existing program or to add a program or programmatic element that deepens the audience's educational experience, increases the active participation or engagement of their audiences, or develops new audiences. So we're not saying that even though the status quo for that organization may be great, we would like this fund to help push them to find new ways to engage audiences or bring in new audiences, which is beneficial to downtown and to the Mesa Arts Center and to the community. The next steps would be to develop the detailed criteria, guidelines, and rating tools that we would need to use for administering the program. I've created an ambitious timeline, but I think it's doable. And I've done that because the seasons for these organizations begin in the fall, and I think it's important that they know what they have to work with and can plan the programming or extra activities accordingly so that they can be successful with them. So we're looking at guidelines and materials being produced in the coming month, program being formally announced, meaning unrolling the criteria publicizing it to the groups in July, having a proposal deadline in August, panel review in September, and either in late September or hopefully early October, being in a position to announce the awards so people can begin their work. And that is the end of the presentation, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Councilmember Kempner. Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate the recommendation. I think this is a sound approach that can have a really great return on investment to the Mesa Arts Center and to the community, because, again, I look at a program like this as really the city investing in the MAC, in the arts groups, and it provides, like you say, incentives and interest in, for other groups who have not previously either performed in Mesa or at the Mesa Arts Center to come to use the facility to engage with Mesa residents to help build audiences and build attendance at the Mesa Arts Center. And if we can do that, I think we also have the ancillary return on investments for downtown in terms of activities and other other sales that can occur. And so I think it's a very interesting concept, as opposed to, I always like the grant opportunity, but this is actually more creative than direct grants, because really the city and the Mesa Arts Center is getting a direct return by using a rental reduction process. So I think this is an excellent proposal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Finter.
I just wanted to express my appreciation to you. I think this is a wonderful suggestion and a way to go. The last 6 months have been a great educational experience for me to watch what your efforts and the staff there at MAC have been to reach out to the community, bring in thousands of people we wouldn't normally have in the downtown area, have people really understand and embrace the wonderful arts center that is theirs, and just amazing to watch how much people appreciate what we have there as a community asset, and family organizations that are able to come in and see their children, you know, perform and do things. Just great things happening there. So I hope you know that I support you, and I know everybody else does, and what you're doing there and what you're trying to do. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Councilman Richards. Oh.
I do appreciate the proposal. I think one thing I wouldn't mind having you consider is groups that, I noticed that we drew the box around nonprofits and other nonprofit groups. I wouldn't mind considering groups that focused on kids and kids' performances, and performances that might bring in their parents and their grandparents that they might not otherwise come to the Arts Center and do it. You know, and a lot of those would happen early on a Saturday morning or on a weekday night or something like that. So it may not, we might be able to find a seam in a theater that doesn't have anything going on, or maybe we can put them down in that area by the contemporary arts because they're smaller groups, or some of those areas. There's another little area back by one of the, I think it's the glass blowing area, there's where they have the Thursday bands play. There's
the Wells Fargo Garden.
Yeah, so there's a lot of little niche places that we could accommodate groups like that if we thought creatively. But I know my kids participate in them. A lot of my neighbors' kids participate in them. And I talk to a lot of those parents at the recitals and ask them if they've ever been to our art center. And majority of them never have. And so I just wonder if there's an opportunity to include groups that focus solely on youth. And they're not doing the performances for profit. They want to do a recital for their kids. And what a neat opportunity. I see how thrilled the Mesa High kids were when they performed, and how amazing that performance was. They really stepped up their game because the venue that they were in was interesting. Well, so I don't know, I just would love it if we could get to a place eventually that we could consider that kind of activity.
Yeah, no, I completely agree that that's a very important segment of the audience to serve, and do want to mention, in case it hasn't reached everybody's awareness yet, that we did make a point of creating a family series in our series next year. So for the first time, we have a packaged family series to attract those folks to the Mesa Arts Center specifically. But the way I envision this is that I first of all, I think that it is nonprofits, but it could be people doing work like that. The only reason that I put the box around nonprofits this first year is that with it being $25,000, which sounds like a lot, but will go fairly quickly, especially if we're lucky enough to attract one or two major groups that haven't used our facility that we would like to see performing in downtown Mesa. But is that as it grows, I feel that if we're serious about calling it a creative economy fund, it has to have a it probably has to have a bigger It has to embrace a larger group of organizations, including potentially for-profit organizations doing activity. I mean, for instance, if I were to think big, if someone wanted to shoot a film in downtown Mesa and use one of our stages as part as a set, for example, I know we'd all be eager to encourage that activity. But I think that this was a way to pilot it, start it with it, and test the waters. And then it gets a little trickier creating criteria for what is and isn't appropriate when you get to for-profit. And so I think if when we venture there, that'll require more time to really come up with the criteria that embrace the appropriate kinds of for-profit organizations for support in doing business in downtown Mesa at the Mesa Arts Center. But community organizations that want to use our space, if they're not a nonprofit, they can find a nonprofit to be a fiscal agent to apply to support them in their application. That usually, in most grant proposals, a fiscal agent is acceptable. So we would welcome community groups who want to come in and use our spaces.
Yeah, I think I just think of there's an organization, Gene School of Dance. They have a little studio. And, you know, they teach those kids for 6 months, and they get together and have a little recital. And they're not charging parents. They're not trying to make money on the recital. The parents just want to see what the kids have been doing for the last few months. And so those are the organizations I think there's good emerging art audiences in. But I agree that when you first pilot it the first year, you've got to kind of find your way and figure it out. And I think it's a great approach to start out with. But just want you to keep that in mind, because that's part of the drive of putting the community in this back in the, you know, in the Mesa Arts Center.
Absolutely.
And really having them be an integral part of the experience. So thanks.
Thank you.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Also want to follow up, we also do have a great partnership with the Mesa Arts Center Foundation that helps provide performance dates for groups that could be, for example, the Gene School of Dance as an educational institution might be the would have an opportunity to do that as well.
Yes, schools and educational organizations, and it's probably worth mentioning that they can go to the website, to the foundation part of the MesaArtsCenter.com, and get information about how to apply for the ACES program, which supports performances by educational organizations at the Mesa Arts Center.
And the other thing I would add is that I would assume that when we create the Creative Economy Fund, that this might be also part of the menu of options to funding entities, because there may be corporations who see the value of stimulating new business coming into arts organizations coming into downtown Mesa, that it could be that they might want to help augment or supplement the city money into the fund, or perhaps some of the granting organizations that we work with, including the Arizona Commission on the Arts or the Piper Foundation or some of the other foundations that historically support the arts. They might see this as a great opportunity for them to help leverage some of their money. So I would hope that I think this is an innovative approach among Valley cities, actually among Arizona cities, in terms of incentivizing or supporting the arts. But I think it creates some opportunities. I would think if I were in the private sector, that would be one of the options I'd want to consider helping leverage my money, because I think we do provide a whole variety of ways for private funding to support programming at the center, specific concerts or series or things like that. But I would think this might be an attractive option for some of our funding partners, or to attract funding that we've never had before. So hopefully this will be part of what we offer to the funding communities to consider helping us with.
Excellent idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? One thing I'd like to bring up, I appreciate as part of your criteria that you're encouraging those to expand existing programs or add programs. I might throw out a little caution that it seems like we may be setting ourselves up to draw a line in the sand and inadvertently cut off some very worthwhile efforts for organizations that have hung in there through very difficult times and have worked diligently to try to expand programs. You know, I appreciate pushing them a little further. I'd hate to have somebody cut off in an attempt to bring somebody new in and therefore leave someone who has really worked hard to be an integral part of our arts center through these really tough times, which we're not out of yet, and all of a sudden they're left hanging. So that's my one concern about that. I get it, what you're trying to do. I applaud those efforts, but let's be a little bit understanding about where we are.
I completely agree with you. We did have a meeting with the founding resident companies and discussed this proposal and discussed the innovative ways they could create those kinds of extra activity that were relatively low cost using their existing performers, their volunteer actors, et cetera, ways that they could accomplish this that would be either free or inexpensive, far less than the amount of benefit they were getting from the rent reduction. And they all seem very comfortable that there were ways that they could be creative in coming up with ways to do what we're talking about. But I agree with you. We don't want to make it insurmountable and make it so that the benefit that the cost is worse than the benefit.
Well, you're in an interesting area because one of the challenges you have whenever you give whatever, whether it's a grant or whether it's a participation, is that people become comfortable with that. And there becomes a sense of complacency. And I think they need to be challenged. I think the worst thing we can do is to let them settle in and expect that almost as an entitlement. So that's why I appreciate you really pushing them to continue to expand and to be creative. Let's just don't push them to the edge of the cliff. Let's do that gently if we can.
Yes, agreed.
Okay? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. The next item is to hear a presentation and discuss 5-year capital plan. Ms. Candace.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Okay.
And I would call you by your full name, but your first name's a lot easier to remember than your last name is.
Right. Candace so, Straro. You just
I
say,
know that.
I know, you say everything you see.
Candace is so much easier as it rolls off the tongue. So.
And it's perfectly fine. This morning what we'd like to do is give you just an overview of our preliminary 5-year capital improvement program. That is the document that was made available last Thursday. It is out on our on the City of Mesa's website on the budget page, as well as our executive budget plan is out there as well. Those were both put out there last Thursday. Just as a reminder, our capital improvement program is a planning tool, and that's what we use it for here in the City of Mesa. It's a multiple-year planning tool. It's related to both the growth and the replacement of our capital infrastructure needs. The council will be appropriating just the first year of the plan as part of the 11-12 budget adoption that's coming up in June. The 5-year plan includes all funding sources. Excuse me. These are sources such as city bonds, local funding, and regional funding that we receive. The CIP, Capital Improvement Program, provides a schedule for all of the capital improvements for the bonds that have been approved by the voters. So what we have in the document that is posted on the website are just the ones that have been approved by citizens in past elections for the general obligation bonds. So I want to make that really clear. That is something that we have changed from this year from previous years. So if you look in the document that's out on the website, anything that's listed as a general obligation bond is one that has current bond authority. We do not need any future authority for those projects. Okay. And that is different from last year's plan. For utility projects, however, we do actually forecast our future bond needs as well as our current bond authority. What that does is allows us to establish a model that we apply to our utility rate models. Okay. So when we look at this particular program, I want to make this clear because this is different from this year from any other year. When you're looking at general obligation bonds, those all have current bond authorization. When you're looking at utility bonds, some of those have current authorization, and some will need future authorization. And I'll go over that toward the end of the presentation, how much we have in each one of those categories. Okay. Our regional funding comes from a variety of sources. We receive federal grants. We receive state grants. We have some light rail reimbursement that's included in this particular plan. And we also have a great deal of regional transportation program reimbursement. We call this RTP. So if you hear us refer to RTP, and those are our street projects. And that is actually part of Proposition 400 that was mentioned earlier this morning.
Question on light rail reimbursement. What does that entail?
That is our Central Mesa corridor, and that is some costs that we have to front, and then we will get reimbursed for those costs.
But what do those costs include?
Those are the land acquisition, and the staffing that we're using, our engineering staff.
I just want to make sure, because
that's
a big cost. When you say light rail, it includes a lot of different components, everything from studies to strips acquisition to the entire construction of a, several million dollar project.
Yes, Mayor. The overall project is a $200 million light rail project that is funded from two sources, regional funding as well as a $75 million federal small starts grant funding. As part of the project, Metro has requested that the City of Mesa provide services to support the project. The largest of that is the land acquisition. So our staff will be assisting them with land acquisition along the corridor, and we'll be paying for it, and then we'll get reimbursed for those services.
Now, land acquisition is everything from a little four-foot strip along the road to land that might be used for parking, or is that included also as part of the land acquisition?
Yes, it's everything from a small temporary construction easement to right-of-way needed for the alignment to park and ride sites.
To power station.
Power stations.
What are those actually called?
TPSS. It's the traction power substation.
Okay.
And then it also includes some services from my department and from the transit departments as well. We have some staff that will be charging, and then we'll get reimbursed for it. One is a project manager that's working with them full-time right now. I mentioned our real estate staff, and then we'll also have some of our PR staff, like Jody, working with the project, and we'll be getting some reimbursements for that time.
Okay. Thank you. For the actual construction of the system.
No.
Well, that's what I wanted to make sure.
No, we're not going to float.
We're not fronting $200 million.
Hoping
for reimbursement. That's the point I wanted to make clear.
I think we're currently scheduling for the June 27th council meeting to bring forward the intergovernmental agreement with Metro to do those services. So you'll see it again later this month.
I'll go ahead and take over the next few slides. For the viewing audience, I'm Anthony Araza, CIP Administrator for the city. What I want to do is give you a high-level look at some of the projects in the five-year CIP program. First one is in the Parks and Recreation Program is the Cubs Spring Training Facility over at Riverview in Northwest Mesa. Now, as you know, the design firm Populous and the construction firm Hunt Construction Group was chosen to lead this project. And that project also includes the parking and infrastructure needed for that entire facility. Next one is public safety, and this is a police substation located in the Fiesta District in West Mesa. The next one is transportation. This probably is the category that has the most complex and diverse funding sources in Mesa's CIP. There are federal grants, as was previously mentioned, MAG regional funds, R Street bond funds, other agency funding, and we also have a little bit of street sales tax and HERF, Highway User Revenue Fund, that will fund some of these projects. Central Mesa Corridor was previously mentioned, so I don't think we need to touch on that. ASU Poly will be installing water, wastewater, and street improvements, and you'll be seeing that shortly here for the construction contract, probably in early June. The next two are Mesa Drive and Southern, Country Club, and Southern. Now, these are intersection arterial street projects. They're just north of US 60 and are part of Mesa's projects in the MAG Regional Transportation Plan. This is where local agencies can leverage 70% of the funding that MAG has with a 30% local match. With this project, these two projects, we are also installing aging utility infrastructure both those sections of projects, and it's just not the intersection project, but we're going all the way to US 60 on these projects as well.
Now, on Mesa Drive, we're also going north, correct?
That's
correct. Included in this?
We're
going north of Southern. Is that included?
The intersection, but then it includes all the way just short of Broadway.
Right, from 60 to Broadway.
That's correct.
Correct. Yeah.
That's not on Country Club, but on Mesa Drive.
Just talking Mesa Drive.
Yeah,
that's what I was referring to.
Next one is Broadway Road, Power to Haas. and Arterial Street in East Mesa, where improvements would include new pavement, storm drain improvements, which are direly needed there, street lights, landscaping, and some intersection capacity improvements. Next one is Power Road, Santan to Pecos, and that is a joint project with Maricopa County and the town of Gilbert. Now, this is a really nice project because this is also a MAG RTP project where 70% of those costs will be funded by the region.
Who is the lead, when I say the lead agency, is that split up as far as direct responsibility for construction?
On Power Road?
Mesa is the lead for all phases.
Yes. Okay, so
including land acquisition.
Okay, so we're the ones that are going to run the land acquisition, the construction, and all that.
Yeah, we,
and
yes.
Then Mesa, Gilbert, and the county are sharing in the cost.
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay.
So somebody asked me that the other day, and I couldn't remember who it was.
We had to work through that, and I think we've found a formula that works, that if we're responsible for the design, we're going to carry it through construction, and that way, and we're obviously spending a lot of time coordinating with Gilbert.
We are, and the county. So, we have monthly meetings with them. You'll be seeing an IGA coming forward later this year between us and the town of Gilbert and Maricopa County on the cost share aspects as well as the lead role.
And I know this is somewhat not off the subject, but related. Gilbert, I'm assuming, solved their couplet problem or dilemma, or that hasn't been totally resolved yet?
The legal claim issue, has that been resolved?
Oh, that has not been resolved yet.
Okay. There was a claim. There's been a, I don't know, is that a claim? Is that the right word to use?
I think it's, yeah. I think there's
so that one of the issue came, yes, that has come back, yeah.
Okay, and that Gilbert is it, basically.
Gilbert has to it's on their, resolve that yes. issue.
It's their property. It's their
It's within Gilbert's limits, project limits.
Yeah.
So. Okay. And that's 3 miles, I guess?
It's from the freeway south to Pecos. So yes.
2.5 miles.
2.5.
Okay.
Roughly.
That is a big project.
No, it is a very, it's a, I think it's over about a $20 million project right now, all as together. We said, all
and that's
together.
That's going to be a really nice
it will be.
Parkway
it,
almost.
And it affects, I mean, as much as it affects Gilbert, it affects our entryway into Gateway Airport and ASU Poly.
Yeah. The southern entrance also closer to Rittenhouse and those.
But I'm just thinking major, you know.
Yeah, it really affects those too.
Yeah, there's a number of major commercial facilities and educational facilities all up and down that. It's kind of the first, also, if I can just take a couple minutes, it'll be the first stretch of the road where we start to try to implement some of the power knowledge corridor elements and be doing some aesthetic improvements along the bridges and so forth as we go north. So it's going to be a very exciting project.
Good.
Okay. With regard to the funding on this project, the neat thing about this is the 30% local match will be split among three parties. So that mitigates Mesa's costs, obviously, to this project. So that's a good thing. Utility and roadway improvements at Alliant Signal Butte. These are the water, wastewater, and street improvements associated around the area for solar. And we head into the water resources area. I mentioned a couple projects that are joint projects, and mostly these are replacing the aging water and gas infrastructure in the neighborhoods, mostly in West Mesa. Then, when, of course, we talked
and that's
about
because
the
because usually water and gas are in the same trench.
That's correct. Share trench. We talked about the Elliott signal.
Whereas water and sewer, hopefully, are not in the same trench.
No, we're very far apart. They're very far apart.
Yeah.
That's correct. In the water, we have improvements at Pasadena Brooks and Lindsay Reservoir. Now, these are reservoirs that primarily serve West Mesa called the City Water Service Zone. Now, this project will help improve pumping capacity, improve electrical and chlorination systems, and improve site security around those three sites. The next one is a Southeast Water Reclamation Plant. We're doing some improvements down in that area, and if viewers aren't familiar with that station, that's over at Power and Baseline Roads. And then we have the Lehigh Crossings Lift Station wastewater lines. These are the improvements down for Lehigh Crossings development that need to be completed so that those wastewater flows coming from that development can be pumped up into the city's existing wastewater collection system.
Councilmember Higgins?
I just wondered, on the lift station, that's paid for by the development of Lehigh Crossings, isn't that? Except we have to put it in first before they can start building houses, I'm assuming.
Well, we collect impact fees, but I don't know that it's a dollar for dollar.
Yeah.
Based on.
Good morning, Councilwoman Higgins. Actually, in this case, this is a regional lift station that was identified in our IIP, which is used to collect impact fees. It's serving not just this development, but actually the Lehigh area.
IIP.
I'm sorry, Infrastructure Improvement Plan, which is the basis of our impact fees. It serves not just this development, but the Lehigh region.
Everyone down below them.
Exactly.
So the direct answer is the impact fees that they pay include a portion that anticipated this cost. It was included in the overall cost.
Yeah, the concept
by
of
which
the plan,
impact fees
the
were.
The concept to, of the plan is to allocate out the appropriate cost by some development unit for development to help share in those costs, so that tries to be equitable.
So the answer is yes. Impact fees are helping to pay for this, and even under if people ask under the new law, it would still be impact fees would be available to pay for costs such as this.
But currently. What is Lehigh using? They are on septic system?
Yeah, the area is currently on septic. It's below the bluff, as you know.
Right.
But the infrastructure was sized such that eventually they can be moved on to the sewer system.
Really, isn't it up going the wrong direction, though? That lift station is north?
No, well, we're using a force main to get the flows
force
up.
Force main meaning?
It pumps sewage.
Pressure.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
These are technical terms. I want to make sure everyone understands
right.
what they are.
So this is being
in other
sized.
Words, you move the stuff uphill.
Right. Yes.
Thank you.
For the new Lehigh Crossing subdivision, along with the future needs of anybody that's down in the Lehigh area below the.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and then we move into the energy resources area. Power Road Baseline to Santan Freeway. This is the largest gas capital project that Mesa's ever undertaken. We'll be installing 20,000 feet of 8-inch high-pressure steel line. And this is mostly for the reliability on the site to connect to Gate Station South around Pecos Road. And that phase of the gas line will be in the Power Road roadway construction project. So this is the first phase of a two-phase gas line project. Then we have regular stations that provide system integrity. And then, of course, we have the aging infrastructure, not only in the Magma area south of here, but also in the West Mesa neighborhoods. Then we move to the electric category, and that's the 4 kV to 12 kV conversion. And eventually, this is to put the electrical system on one homogeneous system, basically, because it's more efficient that way.
And how, then what's the percentage of the conversion so far?
Frank?
Mr. McRae?
Morning, Mayor and Council. We're about 75-80% complete with the conversion. We also have some substations that will be converted as well. Designs of the remaining circuits are almost complete. They'll be complete within the next couple of months, so we should be complete in about 2, maybe 3 years at the most.
Okay. Thank you.
And then we have the improvements at Kelwood Substation, which is located at Broadway and Extension. That's the west area of our electrical service area. Then we have the transmission upgrades, and those are the replacing of the wooden poles that you see to ensure system reliability for approximately 5 miles of the 69 kV system that we have. Okay. Candace?
Yeah, Councilman Fender.
Thank you. I realize these are the highlights. Originally, the CIP that we had was 25 pages long with lots of different projects. And I remember looking through some of them and going, did we ever really make a decision on this one or that one, whatever it might be? And so I'm assuming down the road we'll probably like the Fiesta District Plan and others get more information and
sure.
Because I remember definitely some areas that we were going to have to make some big decisions on, and
right.
I just didn't want to see it roll through and
no,
somebody
and
say, hey, you had a chance to look at it. It's
no.
gone. So,
Councilor, that's why we wanted to be clear. We're covering those that you're going to appropriate in the budget next year, and then the others are a plan document, and we'll come back. We try to do it every year, either during the energy or water resources budget to talk about capital. We did that last year. We probably need to come back again, and as we get closer to, we usually have that discussion as we get closer to a new authorization, kind of talk about what's needed out into the future and update where we currently are. So I would see us doing that probably at the beginning of the calendar year. as we go into that, because we'll be getting to a point where we'll need to think out into the future. You're right. We have an extensive CIP. Anything from probably water and energy, their authorization, and we'll get to it in a second, those authorizations of projects we've already seen and taken to the voters probably expires in the next couple of years.
Okay. Right, it's for the next 4 years.
Right, actually have it on the next slide.
Okay, and then we need to continue having a discussion about the next program. And so we'll bring that probably beginning of the year.
Well, I understand this is an overall plan with overall authorization. Each of these items we deal with individually.
Well, too. And then they come back.
Items come before us because we have to approve contracts to actually construct.
But
there's a lot of planning that goes into that.
I think before we get too far down the road, the councilman says, before we start doing contracts for design and whatever, we need to have those long-term conversations.
Councilman Richens?
Yeah, I mean, that's really where we're set up now, just so everyone understands the process. If it's in the plan, that means the staff is going to move ahead with design and other preliminary efforts as if we're going to do it.
Sure.
Take it to the design stage. We then put it out to bid. The council then, we can decide whether to move ahead with that project at that specific time or not, because we can decide whether to award a contract or not.
Correct.
So that's really the process.
Right.
Overall project, the list, which gives the green light to move ahead with planning, and then final approval on a project-by-project basis as the contracts come before us.
And we do need to come back because, frankly, if we didn't get into all the specific details, I think we gave you some highlights. But when we talked about the water resources budget, we were having a discussion about the rates and the concern about debt service. Recall we talked about how we've reprogrammed a lot of capital. We've kind of pushed it further out into the future to try to minimize the impact. One of it had to do with just slower growth than expected, so there are some projects we said we can push out to the future. So I think we reprogrammed over like $90 million worth of capital. Mm-hmm. So we need to come back in more detail. Probably beginning of year would be a good time and go through all those conversations again.
Mm-hmm. So if we go on, this is really then taking on again, as Chris said, this is just the highlights that we talked about. Those are obviously not all the projects that are in there. There's a large document. The first document that we gave you was just the 11-12 projects. Those are that are scheduled for the upcoming budget and that will be included in that appropriation. The additional document are the remaining years, 12-13 through 15-16. Again, this is a planning document, but if you look here, these are the projects that have funding authorization as we sit today. So either they are grant funded, we are getting the regional reimbursements, or we have current bond authorization for these particular projects here.
So just Mayor and Council, we'll get to the uses. These are large numbers. Obviously, we didn't authorize these in bonds, but what it does show you, and you'll see it, is we've been able to take the dollars that we're expending or that we're authorized through bonds and leveraging that with regional dollars or grants to bring more dollars into Mason. That's why those numbers don't necessarily represent.
These are gross numbers, not net numbers.
These are the full numbers of the total value of the projects, but they're funded by more sources than just what we collect here locally. And we'll show you
the funding sources. This slide here is just showing you the different categories of the types of projects that we have underway. And I do want to make note that these are the projects that are scheduled for 11-12 and beyond and does not include our final budget process, which is the actually carrying over of projects that were scheduled this year that were not being completed. We need to carry that appropriation over into next year to complete those projects. That'll be coming through later. So you will see that 11-12 number, that total number will be changing as we carry over projects for completion.
But that again, Council, and sometimes we have to be careful with that because we show this number, but we know, just as you would imagine, there are projects that are currently underway that will continue into the next fiscal year, projects that will be authorizing in the next couple of weeks, but they'll continue beyond the fiscal year, but we have to track those dollars and rebudget them, if you would, into the next fiscal year. We wanted to be clean and try to show you, here's what the plan was for one particular fiscal year, and then we'll identify the dollars that are being carried over from the prior year. But that obviously inflates the number, and we want to be careful to make sure we're explaining what that difference is.
So in other words, the way you're doing it is, if I decide to buy a $250,000 house this year, I decide to buy it this year. I'm going to pay for it over the next 15 to 30 years. But the way I read that, and we're going to see this.
How about if you're building it, not paying
building
for it?
Building it, not
building
buying
it.
Well, yeah,
because the bonds are more like the mortgage.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a custom home I'm building. Doesn't really change the thing. Doesn't make it, but if it makes you feel better, we're fine.
Thank you.
So what you're saying is, hey, I'm building a $250,000 house this year. That's what I authorized. That's what I decided. Mm-hmm. Fact is, it's going to take me longer than this year to build. And so we're going to say I'm going to spend of that $250,000, $175,000 this year and $75,000 next year.
There you go.
There you go.
Now, that doesn't mean I had different projects. The thing that interests me is I approved a $250,000 project this year. I'm going to build my house.
Yes.
That's what we approve.
Yes.
You know, whether it takes 1 year or 3 years, that's really almost a sidebar.
Right.
Because the main decision is to approve the project to begin with. Because once we approve it,
right,
we're set. We can't stop midway.
Right. But by state law, we have to set the expenditure authorization to include those carryover.
Well, just like you would even if you had a mortgage, you're going to say, I bought this $250,000 house. But when you do an annual budget, you say, what's my mortgage payment?
Right.
Right.
And if your mortgage payment is $1,500 a month, you say, I got to have $18,000 this year to pay for that house. Right. So basically, that's sort of what we're doing. Whether we build the house or
I think the mortgage is more like our bond payment. That's
right.
I know.
It's a planning document, and when we set up the plan ahead of time, so we're setting it up now for next year's projects, for example, we do a cash flow to try to determine what we think we're going to need for those particular projects in next fiscal year. Things don't always work out as planned. Things get delayed, such as our fire stations that we had this year. Some things beyond our control. We weren't able to start when we anticipated. So at the time we set the plan, we did anticipate to finish or get that completion done to that, you know, point. If we don't get there, then we need to carry over those funds into the next fiscal year so that we can appropriate them so that we have the ability to spend them.
But the important thing
is the total cost of the project does not change.
Yeah, and the important thing is that when we approve that project as part of the plan or even specific approval that reached over, those funds were then designated.
Correct.
They were reserved.
They were identified, and they were designated.
Because I don't want it to seem like each year we sort of throw things out there and try and figure it out.
No.
At the time we approve this, whether it's a one-year project that's going to be completed totally within this fiscal year, or whether it's a three-year project, we have now designated, and I hate to use the word restricted because I know there's a technical, but in a sense we've restricted funds.
We've designated those funds to that project.
And we're not scrambling in year three because we know that we're going to need these funds, and therefore they're taken off the table. They're set aside, and any new projects that we approve have got to be paid for out of funds that have not already been designated.
Correct.
That's correct.
Okay. Correct. So if you look at the five-year plan that we have in front of you today, everything on this particular in this particular plan has designated funds for these projects. They are all funded projects. The timing may move between fiscal years, but the funds have been identified. On the next slide, we'll show you our utility revenue bonds that are included in the plan, in the document, but do require future bond authorization. So these are projects that have been identified as a need, either a growth or a restructure on the infrastructure, but at this point need future authorizations in order for us to proceed on these particular projects. So you see that actually starts in 13-14 would be our first identified projects that would require future authorization.
But the reason we included these is because that's what, when we come to you and talk about utility rates, we try to give you a multi-year perspective. So we go ahead and fill in at least our estimate of what the capital needs will be for the utilities for about a 5 or 6 year period. So it gives us a better sense of what the utility rate impacts may be going out into the future.
So what you're saying though is that your bond authorization basically runs out, and you would need, in order to complete these projects, you either need additional bond authorization or you need to find other sources.
Correct.
Okay.
But this is the only area where we go ahead and put in unauthorized but needed capital, just so that it gives us from a planning tool to look at our utility rates out into the future. So,
and it also helps us to look at 2 to 4 years ahead if we are planning to go back to the voters to ask for additional authorization.
Right.
We have an idea.
As we said, the capital improvement program is a planning tool that's used for many different facets of planning. So not just the infrastructure needs, but also our bond election needs, our debt service needs into the future. It's a kind of an all-encompassing planning tool that assists us in our forecasting models.
Okay.
The last slide here is just to take those same types of projects and to the type of funds that they are. So you can see our restricted funds versus our unrestricted versus our bond. And again, our restricted funds would be our grants and our regional money from our reimbursements. Those type of things are in the restricted funds. And then our bond funds. So you can see the bond funds make up the majority of the funding for our CIP. And our restricted funds, if you notice in the first 2 years, 11, 12, and 12, 13, the majority of that money is our regional transportation program, that Prop 400 money coming back into the streets program, helping us to offset costs there.
The most of those are 70-30?
That's correct. That's
70,
that's
regional, 70 regional, 30 local.
Yes.
So there's about,
I guess I'd expect those regional funds to be a little bit higher than that. But
there's about $11.4 million in 11-12. And there's about $10.7 million in 12-13 of that regional transportation money.
So, okay. Mayor, be careful. You're looking at bond funds. That includes utilities, correct?
I'm just trying to – I guess I was expecting the regional funds to be higher, but once again, the Power Road is a three-way split.
That's
so
right.
Even though it's a $20 million project, it's only a $7 million.
We're not appropriating for all the agencies.
I don't know if it's split one-third, 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 but let's assume it is for this purpose.
I remember a lot of...
Not only $7 million shows up, of which 70% of that then would only be less.
A lot of our regional dollars were backloaded into the streets program.
Well, I know that. I'm just looking at the streets program we have.
Sure.
And we have, you know, the regional streets programs we have in this that you just highlighted are Country Club in Southern, Mesa Drive in Southern.
Do we do Mesa?
Power Road.
Power Road. Yeah, those are the three basic...
Big ones.
Broadway's not a regional.
No.
Broadway's not a regional.
No, it's
totally
not a regional.
Bonded. Okay.
Okay.
All righty.
Okay.
Questions?
If there's any other questions.
We will make a note so the beginning of the calendar year we can come back and have a discussion about the larger term. And I think that'll sync up well with the conversations we see coming out of the IMESA subcommittee, maybe during that period of time too, so it'll be a good conversation to have at the beginning of the calendar year.
Okay. Next item is to approve receipt of minutes. That motion from Councilmember Kavanaugh, second from Councilmember Higgins. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Motion passes. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I'd just like to report on a meeting I went to last night. The fire department sponsored a recognition ceremony for Good Samaritans for residents in our area that performed life-saving functions, and it was a very nice event, and one of our own, Mr. Fincher, was recognized there as well. So just want to extend my appreciation to him and to all those heroes that were recognized last night. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Councilman Richens.
Last weekend I went to Ventura, California to attend our National League of Cities Community and Economic Development Steering Committee meeting, where we talked a lot about the state of financing community development activities. This had some makers come in, and we toured another project that was really fascinating that they did in Ventura that had different affordable housing components that were for everybody from working artists to people transitioning out of homelessness in a single project. It was really fascinating.
Thank you. Anything else? I've got a couple things that I'd like to report on Tuesday. Tuesday, we had the first meeting of the IMESA Steering Committee, which was very exciting, a very, very diverse and sharp group that this council appointed, so recommended, and then approved the appointment. And thanks to Natalie Lewis from our staff for stepping in the last second to head that meeting up, because Kathy McDonald had some sick kids, I guess, and couldn't make it. But, boy, pretty exciting to see the energy in that room and people really, really committed to the making a great community and using IMESA as one of the tools. And I think, based on the response we got from them, potentially a very, very powerful tool to bring some great ideas to the table and then come up with some implementation plans and help us out. It's really excited about how that went. The other thing was, just want to let everyone aware, Mr. Brady and I once a quarter attend a meeting which we started right after we took office 3 years ago, and that was Do we have a formal name of that for that?
It does, but it's really long.
It's really long.
Pinal Park.
What is this? It's a group of the cities that are directly affected by development around and to the east of the Gateway Airport. So included in this group are Mesa and Queen Creek, Pinal County, Apache Junction, the State Land Department because of the Superstition Vistas, East Valley Partnership, and Pinal Partnership. We get together once every quarter, usually out in Queen Creek, and the city managers, county manager, and the elected officials to talk about issues that affect all of us, and especially issues that affect Gateway and the Superstition Vista and water and things like that, where in the past we didn't have a whole lot of ongoing current conversation, and so when issues came up, it was sort of a scramble to try and now get together. I'd like you to know that, you know, sometimes we have some pretty pressing issues. For example, one of the major points of discussion this last meeting were the two discussions we now have for residential development in the Gateway area. How Mesa handles our potential threats to the airport is watched very carefully by other communities and how they handle potential threats. And so we talked a great deal about the other communities wanted to know what the specific proposals were, the two residential proposals, how we were handling them, what the next steps were. Those are the kind of discussions we have. The development of the, you know, what used to be the 801 and now is the 24 freeway, flight paths out of Gateway. So we get together every quarter and we have those kind of discussions, and it's been extremely beneficial. Because now we have a forum where we can address issues that are small now but could develop into big ones, and the idea is to keep them from being big. So I just want to let everyone know that we had that meeting, and it's been very successful because we have a good group that gets together and have frank discussion about items of mutual interest. Well, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, I believe you and I and the city manager had a tour of Boeing the other
week. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
We spent a couple hours touring Boeing. First time you're out on the Apache helicopter line. And also,
I've been to that plant probably a dozen times, but never actually into the Apache line.
So it was very exciting having an update on all the fun new programs that are coming to Mesa for longevity of high wage jobs right there in beautiful Northeast Mesa.
Great.
So thank you.
Okay, Mr. Brady.
Thank you. Mayor, just a reminder, we do have another study session next Thursday, and that will have council meeting on the 6th. I also want to share with council, yesterday we had our mid-managers meeting with several of our supervisors, department heads, and managers, and we, during that time, we always recognized exceptional customer service awards to some of our employees. I believe the council has seen these brochures. I'll hand them out again. I just want to let council know, if you hadn't heard, the graphics, the artistry for these booklets that were shared with many of our school children during Earth Day was done all in-house. And not only was it done in-house with our marketing staff, but the graphics were actually designed by one of our solid waste employees who happens to be an equipment operator too.
So you're saying that during your manager meeting, you guys played with coloring
books? Yes, it was very good team building exercise.
That's good to know, Mr. Brady.
So Charlie the Chimp was grown in house by one of our employees, and we recognized him yesterday. I just wanted to share that with council. In addition, we had another really outstanding opportunity to recognize an employee who works in the Energy Resources Department. He was out doing repairs and checking on some equipment as he was driving in a neighborhood. He noticed that there was a home in the neighborhood with the door open, and it just looked like just kind of suspicious to him as he drove by. He made the decision to turn around and go back, and as he did, he actually was able to interrupt a burglary that was taking place at the home and call the police department. As a result of his actions, we received a very appreciative email from the homeowners. And I'll just read a little bit from this because I think this is important. It talks about during the holidays, or Mr. Boyer had the sense that something was not right. He turned around, came back by our house, This frightened the burglars, and they ran from the house. Mr. Boyer called the police and reported the burglary and waited until the police arrived. And then he gave a description of the suspects. They note that because of this, they sustained minor loss and damage to their house. But I think this is the part that we talk to our employees about. This is the statement that makes it all worthwhile. He says, I want to make certain that Matt Boyer's actions do not go unrecognized. This is an example of why we feel Mesa is the right choice for a place to live. So I thought that was a pretty powerful statement coming from our residents. I thought I'd share that with you. And we were able to recognize Matt yesterday and thank him for what he did. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And that's not the first time we've gotten an email or a letter.
Oh, no. Yesterday was just an opportunity to share that. So.
I'm amazed at the number of people who stop me and tell me about a good experience they've had with a city plan. And a lot of times it's like that. It's the city's employees who are out on the out in the community, whether it be a police officer, firefighter, which you hear a lot, but also solid waste. I had one lady pull me aside and tell me a great story about one of our drivers who was driving down the street and saw this lady, and she was sort of struggling to get her garbage cans out, stopped, got out of his truck, went over, helped her, went into the house and helped her. I mean, you know, cool stuff like that. Yeah. And that happens on a recurring basis. Those are not isolated instances, and that's a great tribute to our city employees.
As much as our efforts of our police department to patrol the streets and be out there, if you look at the time and the exposure with the number of times we're in front of people's house with solid waste employees, streets employees,
meter readers.
Energy meter readings, we're the eyes and ears. And so I think we're talking to our employees, and they get it that they're looking after the whole community, just not out there just to do their job. So
that's great. Good. Thanks for sharing that with us.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. That's it.
Executive session.
I just have to learn now that I have my computer.
Sorry.
I keep trying to turn around to the back page. This is like three times in a row I've done that. Ms. Crocker, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
No requests.
I'll entertain a motion to enter an executive session. Have it from Councilmember Richin, second from Councilmember Cavanaugh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving to the executive session. Thank you.